Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. On today's show, creators around the state are trying to do their part to solve the severe shortage of important hospital equipment.
We put in orders, as is every hospital around the country, and we get a fraction of what we ask for.
And the COVID-19 pandemic is claiming yet another victim, local newspapers.
I realized very quickly that I would probably make one or possibly two more payroll cycles, and I would be completely bankrupt.
Also, how the livestock industry is faring through this crisis, as well as international students stuck far from home. Don't miss those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. As more cases of the coronavirus are confirmed throughout the state, it's putting pressure on supplies for healthcare workers. So Wyoming creators, coders, engineers, and others are working on ways to help local hospitals make sure they don't run out. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports.
At the start of the week, Tyler Kerr is one of the few people in the office. It was a busy weekend 3D printing 115 face masks for a local hospital.
We did a full 48 hours of nonstop printing. We were coming in at like 2 a.m. to start the printers again, and my staff all took a well-deserved day off so they could rest and sort of recharge batteries.
Kerr is the Makerspace Coordinator for the University of Wyoming's Student Innovation Center. Makerspaces are places where anyone can come and learn to use emerging technology, like laser cutters and 3D printers, so they can build things. Kerr and other makers around the state are combining their brains, equipment, and supplies to produce personal protective equipment, or PPE, like surgical masks, face shields, and gowns for healthcare providers. The Centers for Disease Control says there are major shortages of PPE, like N95 respirators, because of COVID-19. The CDC is telling healthcare workers to take steps to make sure their supplies can last longer. Kerr and his team are working with a group called the Wyoming Technology Coronavirus Coalition, which began only a couple of weeks ago. Eric Trowbridge is the CEO of the Array School of Design and Technology in Cheyenne. He says he saw people who've been laid off during the pandemic and others express they wanted to help healthcare workers.
We can find the coders around Wyoming or the hardware engineers, software engineers. Maybe we can get them excited and volunteer their time to work on meaningful projects that could hopefully help folks in Wyoming. And so we were able to bring together so many different folks, not only just in technology and healthcare, but in public relations and media. And then the average person was like, hey, I can sew, I can cook. How do I get involved? And so I'm just kind of like, all right, well, come on in.
Trowbridge created a Slack group, which is like an online chat platform where each chat room can have different focuses. The coalition has space for job postings, volunteers, medical supply drives, pitching ideas, and places for hospitals and groups to request what they need. It currently has more than 200 active members.
And this community has just really exceeded, I feel, every expectation of what I initially had an idea for.
But the Wyoming Technology Coronavirus Coalition isn't the only group working on solving supply issues in the state. There's a lot of makers contributing what they can. Spencer Kazara is the vice president of Forge Makerspace in Sheridan. He's leading a similar online community where they share ways to design and manufacture PPE.
The main priority is to provide the hospital with emergency backup supplies should they need it. And of course, also provide them with the information regarding these materials so that they can, you know, make their best informed decision on when or when not to use these materials or products.
The masks aren't meant to protect frontline workers the way an N95 respirator can. They are meant to extend the life of the respirator by covering them with a protective mask. But that could change if hospitals get desperate. Reed Ivazian is the safety manager at the Wyoming Medical Center. He says there are challenges that come with these new products.
The 3D printers can do a lot of cool things, but from the ones we've seen and from what I've been finding on them, they don't fit a face real well. With the 3D printed ones, it's a lot more rigid. We're not writing them off completely because we might get to that point, but we're not liking that as a primary method for right now.
We put in orders, as does every hospital around the country, and we get a fraction of what we ask for.
That's Tim Thornell, the president and CEO of the Cheyenne Regional Medical Center. Officials at both hospitals say they have supplies to last for now, but that won't last them through the pandemic. Thornell says that's why it's great to have local makers, so they can troubleshoot issues as they arise, and then get a big batch of masks printed by a bigger operation, like the UW Makerspace. Right now, most makers are donating their time and resources, though hospitals are trying to help out financially as best they can. Kazara, with the Forge Makerspace in Sheridan, says he hopes these efforts will show how beneficial these makerspaces can be to communities.
I don't think it's very well understood what its purpose is or what the advantage would be to have, you know, essentially a small volume manufacturing shop in your community. The fluidity and adaptability of what we do is amazing to me. And, you know, I just hope that other people will eventually see that as well.
The hope is the relationship between the hospitals and makers can last long past the pandemic. To find out more information about these groups, visit wyomingpublicmedia.org. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
The governor has banned gathering together with more than 10 people because of the COVID-19 pandemic. That makes it hard for places of faith to worship every Sunday. But some churches in Wyoming are finding creative solutions to keep everyone feeling like they're still together. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports.
That's Drew Murray, singing during a worship last Sunday. She's standing in the back of a pickup truck. From neighboring trucks, a guitarist plays along in one, and Pastor Kay Whitman is in the back of another. Everybody's dressed in coats and hats. It's chilly, but a sunny day. This is how the Trinity Lutheran Church in Cody has been worshiping for the past two Sundays, in their cars at the American Dream Drive-In Theater in Powell. Pastor Whitman even delivers her sermon from the back of the truck.
Come to our aid as the coronavirus spreads globally. Heal those who are sick.
Whitman says the plan is to continue until the pandemic ends.
What I realize is we really want to be together. So I was talking to some people the next day on the phone and I said, oh gosh, I think we should all just get in the parking lot and we can just honk at each other.
Chatting with different members of the congregation, Whitman realized that a drive-in theater could work perfectly as a way to practice social distancing, but also enjoy the solace of their community.
There's something that is so bonding about it because you're like, oh, there you are. You're healthy. I see you. You came out here this morning just like I did. We both are longing to be together. It does make you closer.
Share God's peace by honking your horn.
60 different cars all parked together, honking together for worship. It really did give you a sense of unity and that we're all together in this and it's all going to be okay.
That's Dr. Doug Morton. He's a Trinity Lutheran Church member. He says during this crisis, he's turning more and more to his faith to help him get through the crisis of the pandemic and how it's affecting his world.
If you can't meet as your faith group either, that's a real hole. So I think it's great that she's been doing this and getting us all together anyway.
This isn't the only church finding creative solutions to be able to congregate. Churches in Indiana, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina are all turning to drive-in theaters in an effort for in-person community and support. But unfortunately, there aren't enough drive-ins in all of Wyoming for churches to worship. So other congregations are relying on the internet. And for Cody Christ Episcopal Church Rector Mary Cockett, she says it's working, even though lots of members aren't particularly tech savvy.
I would say that folks at Christ Church are actually feeling more connected as a community today than they felt the day before we went into isolation. Because before we did isolation, we relied on people being face-to-face, and it takes an effort to be face-to-face.
Cockett says during this time of crisis, people do want to be together. The church has been doing many things to keep members active and connected, including a calling tree where a list of members call to check in on other members, but they also have live-streamed worship and Zoom meetups.
They see each other's faces and they have an opportunity before we start whatever we're doing to check in with one another, sort of in a face-to-face way. And I just see this sense of relief in being able to see faces.
Wally Johnson is one of those faces. He's the senior warden at the church. For him, nothing really can take the place of being physically in the company of people.
It's not simple for an old guy like me. So can I find that same comfort on a computer, on Zoom, or on Facebook? I can't tell you yet.
It's hard for him to worship over the internet when he's not really comfortable with technology. But Johnson doesn't see any other choice right now, and he says he appreciates the entire community checking in on him and keeping the community connected. This is definitely a challenge all places of worship are experiencing, especially with Easter coming up quickly, in which many of the traditions are interactive, says Cockett. Usually, some involve washing each other's feet and the sharing of a palm.
They are not best sat and watched in a live stream. In our Maundy Thursday service, we traditionally roast a whole lamb.
But Cockett has come up with a solution. A couple of church members will roast the lamb, and there will be a drive-through where people can pick up the roasted lamb. Cockett says communities of faith are more important now than ever.
They're bringing people together. They're helping people reframe and make meaning of this. And they're really bringing good news into people's lives.
Even if it's not perfect for everybody, it creates a sense of normalcy and gives the crisis meaning. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Stay tuned. Coming up, a look at the livestock industry during the pandemic and how land-grant universities got all that land from Native American tribes. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards. In many towns across our region, COVID-19 is shuttering non-essential businesses. Things like hospitals and grocery stores are staying open, of course. But as it turns out, so are livestock auctions. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
This is the sound of a livestock auction at the Twin Falls Livestock Commission in southern Idaho. Jake Billington recorded it for me. He's worked this auction for 28 years.
Ever since I was old enough to walk and talk, I've been around it, been in it, been doing something around there.
Auctions like this are staying open to maintain the food supply chain. That's why they're considered essential. But that doesn't mean these auctions will keep operating like normal. In rural communities, they're often social gathering places, but now many have limits. Sellers are asked to just drop off cows and leave, and as for spectators...
We have limited it down to just serious buyers only, you know, one person per family member.
We've seen many of them take big steps, like reducing the number of people that are there at their auctions.
That last voice is Chelsea Good. She's with the Livestock Marketing Association. The trade group is telling livestock auctions to take precautions, but it's also working to keep the beef moving.
We've worked with both our federal officials, but then also our states and local communities to help get them that critical food supply designation and allow them to continue operating in this important time.
She says auctions are vital to rural communities nationwide. And while some ranchers might be able to market cows online, she says it's important to have multiple bidders in the room. That's what drives prices up so ranchers can make a profit.
candidly, that's what livestock auctions are all about. We've got an auctioneer, we've got a competition and bidding. We're working for that producer.
And some of those prices could use a boost right now. The pandemic has created a lot of market uncertainty. Prices for things like bulk burger you'd buy at Costco made historic gains as people rushed to the store to stock up. But other types of meat have taken a hit. Eric Belasco is an associate professor of agriculture economics at Montana State University.
Beef primarily is a product that you consume a lot of in restaurants. And, you know, given that a lot of restaurants are shut down, that certainly dims the outlook for demand for those products.
Belasco says a weak beef market may also reflect weakness in the economy overall.
We tend to think of beef as a normal economic good.
Or in people speak, something we eat regularly. But,
you know, when we're in a recession, we see reduced demand for those products. So if you look at the futures market, look kind of at the longer term projections on prices, those are also going down.
Even beyond markets, the supply chain could face another challenge. Meat packing plants. The facilities that turn a cow into burger or steaks have been consolidated over the years. There's fewer of them, and they handle a lot more meat. There's also a lot more people in a single facility who can get sick and pass that along to other workers and shutter a plant.
Yeah, it is critical that we sort of keep those somewhat isolated from any outbreak. And that, you know, that's a huge area of uncertainty because you can imagine, especially some of the larger packing plants, if they were to shut down, you'd see a remarkable impact on the market for beef.
If a packing plant closes, a lot of meat can't be bought and processed. And that hurts everybody from ranchers to auction houses to distributors to consumers. Belasco says if big ones close,
then we would see prices increase. We'd also see a lower supply. So we might see less beef on the shelves and we would see it at a higher price.
Packing plants have reported some cases of COVID-19 and some workers sent home. But the good news is federal inspectors will still be around inspecting the meat. And according to the CDC, there has been no evidence that food or food packaging can pass along the virus. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
If you've spent time on a college campus lately, you may have encountered a land acknowledgement, recognition of the tribes whose ancestral land the institution is built on. But American land-grant universities also owe their founding to the sale of indigenous lands. The 1862 Morrill Act granted over 17 million acres for states to sell and raise funds to endow the institutions. Tristan Ottone, editor of High Country News' Indigenous Affairs Desk, spent the last 2 years tracing the origins of that land. He spoke to Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr about his investigation.
Basically, the elevator pitch is that expropriated indigenous land is what funded and founded the system of higher education known as land-grant universities in the United States.
Right, and the myth about land-grant universities is that this was frontier land that was sort of gifted by the federal government.
Yeah, that is one of the big things that we really wanted to look at, is this idea that land-grant universities were just sort of given land, free land that nobody was using. Obviously, with our understanding of the United States these days, we know that that's not true. I think abstractly, people sort of understand that the United States was not an occupied territory. But I think the exciting thing that we've been able to do is use hard data to sort of show how land came into the possession of the United States and then was sliced up, and this particular slice given to land-grant universities. So one of the big things about this story is making sure that people understand that there is a very, very strong mythology around land-grant universities and the United States as a whole, and that data shows something very, very different.
And the University of Wyoming, which licenses Wyoming Public Radio, is part of that system. So where did UW's Morrill Act land come from?
University of Wyoming was granted 90,000 acres. Those 90,000 acres came out of a total of 4 different land cessions. And the amount that the United States paid for title on those lands was $1,954. while the University of Wyoming was able to raise approximately $73,356. We believe that the University of Wyoming still benefits as well from mineral acres that would have been associated with those original Morrill Act grants. So there are still a number of states and universities that are benefiting from these lands. And I think the sort of next step that we have as reporters, not only at High Country News, but at also local outlets, is to start getting a sense of what that benefit has continued to be over the years from that initial dispossession of land from indigenous communities.
And you've made all of your data and your methodology from this investigation public. What are you hoping people do with that?
Yeah, all of our data is available for download. We've made all of the information that we are using, reporters, researchers, historians, tribal historic preservation officers, etc. Anybody who wants to see how we put this thing together can do that and download it and use that information in essentially whatever way that they're really hoping to. With reporters, I'm really hoping to see more people sort of dive into the information and find the stories of actual real people that are impacted by this history.
Do you think that your investigation will spark conversation and eventually action on campuses like the University of Wyoming?
Well, we hope so. There's obviously a really, really heavy conversation that I think universities should be having, and we're beginning to see that happen on social media, at least, and a lot of folks that are demanding that universities pay more attention to the data that we've put out and the story that we've put out.
And you mention in your piece at least one example of a university that has been conscious of all of this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, South Dakota State University has taken a sort of attack that we were somewhat surprised by, that they had gone through, not only identified the land and its original inhabitants, but also taken steps to make sure that the revenue that's being produced from those lands is still going to indigenous students. I suspect one reason that has happened is because the president of South Dakota State University is an indigenous person. As I mentioned before, Wyoming and other states have the opportunity to make those moves if they so desired. We've also seen that folks have said that maybe revenues should be used to buy lands for affected tribes and start replacing land base. You know, I think there are a lot of different ways that this can work. And I don't think there's one size fits all for each university and each tribal nation. But I think that when universities start having conversations with the tribal nations that were impacted by their presence, there can be some sort of consensus that starts to grow.
The findings of your investigation are obviously pretty bleak, but as somebody who covers indigenous communities, it's really energizing to see investigative reporting and investigative resources poured into something like this, and to see that there are outlets and readers who are hungry for this kind of reporting. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for reading and supporting too. I mean, I'm glad. You know, I think when it comes to sort of the state of indigenous media, that what we have seen at High Country News and at other places is that there is a really, really big appetite for reading news from Indian country. And I think as well, people are really, really primed to read things that they're not prepared for. And when I say not prepared for, I mean that, you know, as a desk at High Country News, the team really works hard to make sure that we're covering stories that nobody else is covering. That means sort of stepping away from the stories that are making headlines or might be making the rounds on social media, and really pushing a little bit further to make sure that we are finding stories that have real impacts and really open up our understanding of the world a little bit differently.
Well, Tristan, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for taking some time to talk about this.
Sure. Anytime. Thanks. Thanks for taking the time and reading, too.
That's Tristan Ottone, editor of the Indigenous Affairs Desk for High Country News, speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr. You can read his investigation at hcn.org or in the latest issue of the magazine. When we return, a multifaceted look at the census, a conversation with grocery store clerks on the front lines of the pandemic, and more right here on Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. Amidst a global pandemic and a presidential election, there's another big issue that will affect Americans for years to come, the 2020 census. The Mountain West News Bureau takes a look, beginning with reporter Nate Hedgie.
You probably got a letter in the mail recently from the Census Bureau asking you to fill out their survey. And maybe you're thinking, I don't have time for this. I just lost my job. The coronavirus is spreading across the country. But filling out that survey to help the U.S. Census Bureau get a full and accurate count of America is really important because...
It's how we distribute our public funding.
That's Evan Curtis with the Utah Governor's Office. He helps out with census outreach efforts. And he says federal and state agencies figure out how much money to give an area based on how many people there are.
So these are big programs like Medicaid, CHIP, Title I school funding, transportation funding, things that impact a lot of people.
The census will also inform political representation. How many lawmakers a place gets to send to state capitals in D.C. and the new districts they come from.
And with the West growing and changing so rapidly, it's going to be really important to get these accurate counts and make sure that everyone is represented fairly.
But there's a big catch this year. COVID-19 is throwing the census off its game. Curtis says college students have left campuses early, which could decrease the population count in some towns. And some rural Americans aren't getting their census invitations delivered because of delays. I'm Nate Hedgie in Salt Lake City.
And I'm Noah Glick in Reno, Nevada. Even with no delays, some residents here might not respond to the census anyway. Latinos. Nevada's Latino community accounts for at least 29% of the population, but historically, that community doesn't trust the federal government. This distrust was exacerbated when the Trump administration proposed adding a citizenship question to this year's census. Michael Moreno works with the census in the state and does outreach within the Latino community.
There are so many undocumented individuals that live in our communities. They would have hesitated and perhaps not even participated in taking the census.
The administration's proposal to add the citizenship question failed, but many Latinos are still apprehensive. Moreno wants to reassure people that the process will be safe, secure, and confidential.
That information will not be shared by U.S. Census Bureau employees or government employees with any state, federal, or local agencies, law enforcement, IRS, immigration.
He says there are stiff penalties for census workers if they do share this confidential information.
Those penalties are $250,000 fine and 5 years imprisonment.
Still, there's a concern that many in the Latino community still won't participate, and that will ultimately lead to official counts being lower than reality. I'm Noah Glick in Reno.
And I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. There's another group less likely to take part. In the last census, Native people living on reservations were undercounted by nearly 5%. Michael Yellowplume is heading up census outreach efforts for the Northern Arapaho tribe. At an educational event in early March, he explained to tribal members how an undercount could hurt them.
A lot of families depend on TANF.
That's temporary assistance for needy families. The Indian Health Service is also crucial.
The government funds all of that, so if we're low on numbers, then we're going to be low on the funding that you need for the people.
Still, there's a big issue this year that could make response rates even lower. For the first time, the census is being conducted primarily online.
Yeah, I believe that's the biggest obstacle that we run into is people don't have access to the internet.
On the Wind River Reservation, only a third of households have internet access. There was a plan to set up internet hotspots around the reservation, but that's been put on hold by the COVID-19 pandemic. There will be all sorts of consequences from a low count. Take housing. Yellowplume says census numbers inform federal funding for housing, which is a persistent problem on the reservation. Charles Washakie agrees. Washakie directs the housing program for the Eastern Shoshone tribe, who share Wind River with the Northern Arapaho.
Oh yeah, we have like 2-3 families in homes and stuff. We know, you know, which families are have multiple families in them, the units and stuff.
But here's the problem. He says many families won't disclose those numbers on the census for fear of losing their housing.
If we're overcrowded in most of our units, it helps us with getting funding. People don't understand that.
He says his office is chronically underfunded. They haven't built a new unit in over 20 years, but he hopes an accurate count could change that. Just another example of how the 2020 census could be transformative here, for better or for worse. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
Local journalism has never been more important. Communities are anxious for real information. How many cases of COVID-19 are in their county, or where can they get a test? At the same time, local newspapers across the country are losing advertising revenue as businesses shut down. That's creating a dilemma. How do you cover the news when you have no money? As part of the public media initiative, America Amplified, our Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie takes us to one small town where this is playing out.
Publisher Ben Olson is exhausted.
It's a ton of work. And it's a ton of stress.
He appears close to burning out, trying to keep his readers up to date with the latest coronavirus news. Like the rest of the country, North Idaho has a growing number of confirmed cases. But at the same time, the number of reporters and staff at Olson's free weekly newspaper, the Sandpoint Reader, has shrunk from 4 down to just 1.
I want to get my staff back to work, number one, because they're like my family, and I feel responsible for them. But number two, I cannot handle this by myself.
Olson had to lay off his staff after local restaurants and bars were forced to shut down in an effort to curb the spread of COVID-19. Those businesses often advertised events in the Sandpoint Reader's calendar. But with no events, that means no money.
I realized very quickly that I would probably make one or possibly 2 more payroll cycles, and I would be completely bankrupt.
It's a problem that's reverberating throughout the Mountain West's media landscape. The COVID-19 pandemic is deepening the cracks and fissures in a centuries-old business model, one that traditional newspapers and alt-weeklies rely upon. There's no journalists without advertising dollars to pay for them. Money from subscriptions and circulation revenues can only go so far. So from Sandpoint, Idaho, to Bozeman, Montana, to Wyoming and Denver, media companies are cutting hours or laying off staff. Ben Smith is a media columnist with the New York Times.
Well, this is a real disaster for media that are supported by advertising in general.
He says some traditional newspaper chains were already on life support to begin with. They've been cutting costs by shutting down papers and laying off staff. COVID-19 just sped up the clock, and Smith doesn't expect a happy ending.
Like, I think we're going to wind up with fewer journalists next year than this year, just as it has been for the last several years.
But at the same time this is happening, demand for breaking news on COVID-19 is rising a lot. Still, Smith argues the answer isn't a federal bailout for struggling newspaper chains. Instead, it's a new business model, going nonprofit.
I think there is an increasing recognition that journalism is a public service, is like, you know, it's a utility like water and like electricity in terms of keeping a community going, and kind of an appropriate outlet for philanthropy.
It's a business model that the nonprofit news outlet, Montana Free Press, embraced a few years ago. Editor-in-Chief John Adams.
Most of our revenue comes from members who donate to us similar like they would to public radio.
And right now, he says, they're doing pretty well financially. They've seen an uptick in donations during the pandemic.
In a way, I hate to say it, it's been good for business because right now, when people are home wondering what's going on, looking for trustworthy sources of information that aren't rumors, that aren't Facebook memes, that aren't, you know, all these other sources of misinformation that are flying around out there on the internet, they're turning to news organizations. And I think that's good for business as long as your business doesn't rely on advertising.
But many nonprofit organizations are also funded through grants, wealthy philanthropists, and businesses. And now as the nation faces a steep economic downturn, more nonprofits will be fighting for fewer slices of the pie. That's what Sandpoint Reader publisher Ben Olson worries about. It's why he thinks going nonprofit isn't the answer for his paper.
I do believe there is still a small market that operates outside of the national market where you can have community-supported newspapers that can be robust and high quality.
And he says advertising revenues from local restaurants and bars were growing before the pandemic struck. His profit margins were still tight, but his business model worked. Now things are a lot tougher.
I know it's going to be harder to produce these papers, but I don't think it's going to end. I hope not.
And there may be some hope out there. The $2 trillion stimulus package includes loans for small businesses to cover costs over an 8-week period. And as long as they keep their staff on payroll, they won't have to pay it back. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
It's a scary time, with social distancing and isolation becoming the norm. Meanwhile, grocery store workers are on the front lines, putting their health at risk to keep store shelves stocked and grocery carts full. Late last week, at least one grocery store chain announced it's offering all hourly employees an appreciation pay of $2 more an hour. The Mountain West News Bureau's Noah Glick talked to some store workers and filed this report.
Walk into many grocery stores these days and you'll see two things: lines and empty shelves.
Deli, you have a call holding on 5836.
Looking down the bread aisle, the bread is completely picked over with the exception of some organic English muffins. And it looks like some gluten-free artisan baker bread. One thing I'm noticing, though, is people are not abiding by the 6-foot rule from the CDC. There's definitely no way to do social distancing here at this grocery store. While many businesses are shutting down to help stop the spread of COVID-19, grocery stores don't have that luxury. And the people that work there, like cashiers, don't really make that much. At most, about $15 an hour. But like healthcare workers, they're considered essential.
My employees, I'll tell you, have been great. I can't commend them enough.
That's Bill Presswood. He's the grocery manager at Village Market in Incline Village, Nevada.
We have provided, some hand sanitizer stations up front. We do have Clorox. We have different products up there. And so I think they feel pretty comfortable.
Presswood says for the last few weeks, the store has implemented new cleaning standards to try and keep the virus at bay.
So I do have two new people I hired just for today to help out up front bagging and to help out wiping down shopping carts and door handles and such.
The store is also dealing with an influx of customers.
In all these years, I've never seen anything like this.
That's Pam DeJean, one of the store's cashiers. She says no one really knows what's going to happen next, so their only option is to clean as much as possible.
Until they really continue the research and find some sort of treatment or vaccine that's effective, this is the best we can do.
Still, DeJean says she's never even questioned whether or not she should show up for work, even though she says her and her husband are both in a high-risk group.
The community here, they need people to be here at the store. Everyone needs supplies and groceries.
Now, grocery stores aren't really special in terms of disease transmission.
It's just a place we have to go, so there's that potential to be in contact with other people.
That's Brian Labus. He's an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
So for the people working there, any risk would be dealing directly with customers. So if you're touching items that they're touching, you know, like something on the checkout machine, or you're handing money back and forth or things like that, those kind of things can be contaminated with the virus and it can be passed on to the worker that's there.
So right now, being a cashier could be a hazardous job, and many workers are asking for hazard pay. Dan Kalish is a managing partner at HKM Employment Attorneys.
If you don't have a collective bargaining agreement or separate agreement for hazard pay, then generally no local, state, or federal law really provides it at this time.
Kalish says overall, protections for grocery store workers come in three forms: union contracts, laws, and overall goodwill of companies. And without a collective bargaining agreement or protections in statute, many grocery store workers must rely on the generosity of their bosses.
These are employees that have been working for these companies for years, often assisting them in phenomenal profits in the last 5 years. We would hope that the companies would come back and provide some assistance to employees in such hardship and in such difficult times.
It's a difficult time for cashier Pam DeJean, and she says it's difficult for everyone.
The customers, the employees, all of us, we're all concerned because we don't know what's going to happen next.
Until we know what's going to happen next, here's what we do know. It's important to wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and maintain at least 6 feet of distance between people, all of which is a bit harder when you're busy working at the local supermarket. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
Next up, a couple returns from their rafting trip honeymoon to find a changed world.
Music.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards. The COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted lives around the state of Wyoming. Maybe no one as much as international students attending the university. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao talks to a couple of students who are trying to navigate life far away from home.
Ana Arroyo and Maria Reshkina were playing a tennis match in Denver when they found out that their whole athletic season came crashing to an end.
I mean, it was really shocking because, like, overnight, everything was canceled.
That's Ana. She's a senior studying microbiology at the University of Wyoming. She's from Spain. It wasn't the first time she's heard of the coronavirus, though. She knew how quick it was spreading because her family was under quarantine before it hit Wyoming. But she never expected the virus to affect her life so drastically. It was the same for Maria Reshkina. She's a sophomore at the university, and she is from Moscow, Russia.
It actually was kind of shocking for us because we did not expect that coming to Laramie.
Didn't expect quarantine, the end of the tennis season, and to have to finish their classes online. This was really hard for Maria.
Yeah, for me it was really emotional because basically without practice and the classes online, I just lost my purpose to being like in the United States.
All of their teammates are also international students. So when the University of Wyoming announced that all classes were going to move online, 4 out of 7 teammates flew back home almost immediately.
Our teammates, international students as well, they wanted to go home so bad. So as long as they announced that our classes were online, they just bought a ticket and left immediately right after that day.
At first, they thought they'd eventually play tennis again, but their season and scheduled matches were suspended tentatively. But they were told that they could still practice and they'll be back to playing competitively.
And after a couple of hours, they just announced, oh no, we canceled everything.
So they felt like they lost a sense of purpose, as students and athletes. Tennis made up most of their daily lives at the university. And most of their schoolwork involved lab experiments because they both are science majors. To make things worse, Maria can't go home because her country's borders are closed and everything is under lockdown.
I haven't seen my family, I don't know, like 9 months from now on. And I really miss them and it's really hard and tough.
Ana also cannot leave the U.S. She has to stay here because if she leaves, she can't return. No one from Europe is allowed to enter the United States due to the pandemic. And there's something else that makes all of this much harder. Ana is supposed to graduate this May.
And my parents were coming over to the States for my graduation, but they can't anymore. I mean, our flight was May 14th and it's not canceled yet, but I'm just guessing it will be because everything in April is canceled.
Having no immediate family support and friends from home, they rely a lot on each other as teammates.
We're trying to work out all together all the time at home as long as I have my teammates, like just a couple of them, but they're biggest my support right now.
Even though it's all bleak right now, Ana and Maria are not giving up. Here's what Ana said.
We have hope, but we understand we have to be patient because every continent now has suffered this virus. So it's our turn now and we just have to be patient and do whatever we can. We have to stay safe and stay at home.
For Maria, her future holds uncertainty, but she knows that she'll be able to finish school. For Ana, she got a paid job in a graduate program. Even though they're strangers in a strange land, they know they'll make it through because they have each other. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Nina Rao.
Laramie residents Shay Lynn and Austin Woody left for a 5-day rafting trip in southeastern Utah on March 13th. They had just eloped and wanted to celebrate that, along with some birthdays, while relaxing on the water. The day they left on their trip without cell phone service happened to also be the day when a national emergency was declared and things started rapidly changing. When the Woodies returned from their trip, the world suddenly looked very different. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim talks with the newlyweds about their journey.
It was me and my sister's birthday. We like to go on a rafting trip for our birthday each year. We're going to the San Juan, and everybody that we invited bailed except for there was four of us. We launched on the 13th, and we were on the water until the 17th of March.
Friday the 13th.
That's kind of interesting timing. So you guys got married on this trip? Was that expected, planned?
We had decided to elope, but in Wyoming, we needed to get legally married. My sister wanted to marry us, but it had to be in Wyoming. So one of the anesthesiologists that I work with at Premier, shout out to Lance Proctor, he came over on short notice that Thursday morning, and he married us in our living room. And then that afternoon, we left for the river.
So when all of this was happening, I guess, when did you first start hearing about the COVID concerns?
Kind of before we left for the river. We had heard about it going on, but it had been more of like in a joking manner, like, have you heard what the cure for coronavirus is? It's Lyme disease. Things like that, but it hadn't really become a legitimate concern at that point. We were still able to get a hotel room in Moab on our way down to the river, and there really wasn't anything major going on.
When did you guys realize that things were not as they were when you left?
We were listening to the radio once we took off the river quite a bit and realizing how much more dire it had become. But when we got to Moab, Utah, they were really trying to shut town down there. The only place we could find to eat that was open was Denny's, and they were closing that night at 10 p.m. and they had an order that nobody was allowed to check into hotels. Just being as remote of a town as that is and all the spring break rush, I think they're really just trying to encourage people to not come to Moab. So that was kind of where it really sunk in that things had changed while we were on the water.
Did that make either of you nervous?
Yeah. I mean, just seeing like the signs come in into Moab, like lodging restrictions, and then go into stores and seeing the signs on all the doors that they were closing at a certain time. And, you know, there was just inavailability of everything, kind of.
Yeah, and certainly when we got to Moab, there was kind of a sense that we were supposed to be home and we needed to hightail it and get home and not use any other town's resources, try to get to our own hometown.
In that sense, are you glad you guys took the trip and got some fun in before you couldn't?
Of course. I wish we could have stayed on it a lot longer now. 3 weeks would have been great.
Yeah. We've just been at home. Weirdest honeymoon ever. Get it locked down.
Yeah. I imagine you guys were not expecting this.
No, we were kind of expecting to go back to work when we got home and just have somebody be like, oh, you know, how was your trip? Did you get anything good for your birthday? Well, I got this husband over here, so that was nice.
I know that you guys didn't have a big honeymoon plan, but I imagine it's kind of a bummer not to be able to hang out with a ton of people right now.
Yeah, it's kind of weird coming off the water and being married and then not seeing any of our friends or anything. Because usually we're pretty social people generally, and we would have normally seen a lot more people, and to not see hardly anybody has been strange. And the wedding on the river was really fun. My sister married us on the river, so it was cool. So we got two weddings out of this whole deal.
Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Good luck with everything.
Hey, we're so glad you could join us for this episode of Open Spaces. It's no problem if you missed something. You can listen to all these stories again at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. And you never have to worry about missing an episode if you sign up for the Open Spaces podcast. Find it anywhere and everywhere you now get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.